Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On January 11th, the internet activist and pioneering computer programmer Aaron Swartz took his own life at age 26. When Aaron Swartz was just 14, he helped develop RSS, which revolutionized the way we all use the internet. He also helped develop the architecture for the Creative Commons licensing system and built the online architecture for the Open Library. Aaron Swartz was facing up to 35 years in prison, 35 years, for allegedly downloading almost 5 million documents from the subscription-based academic journal JSTOR at an MIT computer lab. JSTOR had requested federal prosecutors drop the charges, but the Department of Justice refused to back down. Aaron Swartz's suicide has reignited the debate and the conversation about open access to knowledge. In a recent article in the San Francisco Chronicle, UC Berkeley law professor and internet copyright law expert Pamela Samuelson wrote, quote, "As a society, we want wider access to that knowledge because it will lead to further creative work and learning. As an internet activist and visionary, Swartz understood the internet's potential to radically reduce the costs of providing global access to knowledge, so long as unnecessary restrictions do not stand in the way." End quote. Samuelson says copyright has become the single most serious impediment to access to knowledge. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how copyright laws have affected our access to information in the digital age, how much information online is actually free, and how much is fee-based. Where do you stand on this issue? Do you think intellectual property should be shared freely or regulated? And if so, how? Who should make these decisions? Today, we are joined by Parker Higgins. He's an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. He previously lived in Berlin, where he worked for the sound sharing platform SoundCloud. And Parker joins us in studio. Hi, Parker. Welcome back.
Thank you, Rose.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Jessica Richman. She was an acquaintance of Aaron Swartz. And after his death, Jessica and Eva Vivalt started a Twitter campaign, hashtag PDF Tribute, to honor Aaron and the open internet he fought for. The campaign encourages researchers to offer free access to their academic papers online. Since then, thousands of files have been shared via Twitter. Jessica is also co-founder of Science Citizen, a nonprofit that encourages academic scientists to include citizen science in their research. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Jessica, let's start off with you. It's been so amazing to read about Aaron's life since his death and to read about the reaction and to see how this has really reignited this debate about open access to knowledge. And first of all, what was your reaction when you heard about this horrific tragedy?
Oh gosh, I don't even know how to start. It was terrible. I mean, he was a truly, I mean, everyone's sort of a unique individual, but he was just truly did so much with his time and did so much and was so focused on bettering the world in the ways that he saw valuable. And it's a terrible loss for all of us. I mean, he did so much in the time he had on Earth, and it was really inspiring. There's a really wonderful, there are a few wonderful things that people that, you know, knew him really well said, like that we should try to make a world that wouldn't kill him. Mm. That just touched me so deeply. And I thought, you know, we really have to do something to move the causes forward that he believed in.
And what about you, Parker? What was your reaction?
I could describe it the same way that I had met him a couple of times, and we had worked together on copyright issues and copyright activism in the past. And he really had a gift for taking a problem, especially a complex problem like copyright, and boiling it down to its simplest parts and seeing exactly what needed to be addressed. And so I think that that's the way that you can accomplish as much as he was able to in 26 short years. As someone who continues to work on making a copyright system that makes sense, it's frustrating to no longer have his presence there.
And again, he was accused of downloading almost 5 million documents from the subscription-based academic journal JSTOR at a computer lab at MIT. Parker, are you still surprised that the government came down so hard on him, facing up to 35 years in prison for this?
Well, I'm surprised in the sense that it doesn't fit with my sense of justice, or really, I think anyone who looks at it and comparing the alleged crime to the charges. But I'm not really surprised to see the computer crime laws abused that way. It turns out that they're frequently abused, and that they carry these very long maximum charges. And actually, defending themselves, some of the prosecutors have said, well, he wouldn't have gotten 35 years. You know, he wanted to set up a plea bargain. But a system where prosecutors can throw the book at you and then and kind of force you to plead guilty, declare yourself a felon, in order to just get 6 months in jail, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, what would you add to that, Jessica?
Oh, I love the way you put that. I think you said it really well. Like a system in which the defense, like the best putting something in the best light to say, well, you wouldn't have really gotten it anyway. Mm. It just shows how unfair and corrupt the system is in the first place, where you aren't actually charged with, or you aren't actually subject to the time that you would get, and you can sort of play around in this nebulous world where people can make these incredibly harsh threats and then possibly enforce them and possibly not. I mean, imagine the kind of stress and uncertainty that would put someone under. So yeah, I think, I mean, it's sort of a topic for another day, you know, what to do about our prosecutorial system, but I feel like that's an important topic and an important piece of what happened with Aaron Schwartz.
Yeah, and it is important to point out the law, Aaron's Law, which has been proposed by California Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren. This bill would eliminate the avenues by which the feds could pursue those who violate terms of service agreements or change their computer's unique identifiers. Are you hopeful about this bill, Parker? Do you think it'll pass? Is there a lot of support behind this?
Well, it remains to be seen. It hasn't been introduced on the floor, and you know, we still need to see whether sponsors come out. I do think that it's long overdue, and I think that Aaron's tragedy was high profile enough that it's really drawn attention to this problem that we've had for a long time. You know, this hacking law was developed in the mid 1980s, and computers and the way we use computers and the number of people that are using computers innovatively, that's changed a lot since 1986.
And Jessica, when you look at how this debate around open access has really been reignited in the national conversation, I'm sure in your circles you talk about this on a regular basis, but how has it changed the way that you speak about these issues?
I think it's given a lot more urgency to it, and I think that's a really good thing. I mean, so the idea of open access and of, you know, that scientific journals, for example, are locked up behind paywalls that make it hard for the average person to access them and to learn from their knowledge, and it's sort of a perennial refrain of, we really should do something about this. This is a bad system, but it's an entrenched system and it has a lot of entrenched interests in it. And I think Aaron Swartz's tragedy, I mean, one good thing that can come out of it is that it's given a lot of urgency to that and given a lot of public focus to it.
What would you say, Parker?
I agree. I think that this particular, the open access movement is, it's mature. It's been around for, in articulated terms, for at least a decade. And so this isn't people rushing to find a solution to a problem that we didn't know existed. This is, it drew attention to something that people have been working on for a long time, and it's good to see national attention there.
And I'm curious, has anyone looked at how much information is free online versus how much is fee-based? Because those of us who maybe don't really work with academic journals might be surprised by some of this and think, wait a minute, I was under the impression that almost everything was free. Maybe not, you know, a few newspapers charge if you read over a certain amount of articles, but other than that, most is free. Jessica, have you looked at that, or has anyone looked at that?
That's a really good question. I don't know the numbers on, you know, what percentage is open access and what percentage is free. And I think part of that is it's a confusing patchwork landscape. It's a lot like software licensing, where some things are free after a certain period of time. Some things are free only if the author publishes it, but no one else. Some things are free, two people have certain different levels of academic access. It's this weird patchwork of free, open sometimes, open later, open to some people, open to other people. Hmm. That really makes it hard to tell what people's rights are. And I think that was actually part of the power of PDF Tribute, is people are doing something that was kind of risque, but you know, depending on the terms of your particular contract with your particular publisher, was either totally okay or totally not okay. And it was sort of impossible for anyone to tell without looking closely into each case to figure out why or how.
And Parker, we were talking before the show, and you said that when you read science journalism, for example, more often than not, they cite a study, and you try to find the study or the research, and many times it's behind a paywall, and you can't get access to it.
Right. And it's been published in one of these major journals, but those journals charge for access. And I think that's one of the things that makes this kind of a dark matter problem, where it's if you are affiliated with a university, if you're a professor and you have access to the library, that library may subscribe to JSTOR to the journals in question. And so you don't see that this isn't available to the public. And the journalist who wrote the story got contacted by the academic in question, and so they might not see that it's not open to the public. But there are all these benefits that would come from the public having general access, and the lack of those benefits is hard to measure.
Yeah, I think one thing to add to that is sort of the rise of massively open online courses and other ways of bringing information out of the university into the public has sort of made public awareness of this a little bit easier. I think, you know, like you said, it's a very mature movement to want to make journals open access, but only now are other factors starting to come into play that make it palatable and even understandable for the average person that this is a problem. The idea that MIT is opening their courses in Stanford and all these, sort of just making this available to the world with Coursera and Udacity and all sorts of platforms like that, it's made it so that, you know, so the idea that academic information should be public has more currency, and it's easier to think of how academic journals should, of course, just fit into that.
That is Jessica Richmond. She was an acquaintance of Aaron Swartz. Again, on January 11th, he hanged himself in his Brooklyn apartment just at the ripe age of 26, weeks before the start of his trial. He was facing up to 35 years in prison for allegedly downloading millions of documents from the subscription-based academic journal JSTOR at an MIT computer lab. JSTOR had requested federal prosecutors drop the charges, but the DOJ refused to stand down. After his death, Jessica and Eva Vivalt started a Twitter campaign, hashtag PDF tribute, to honor Aaron and the open internet he fought for. And since then, tens of thousands of files have been shared via Twitter. Parker Higgins is an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about how copyright laws have affected our access to information in the digital age. Where do you stand on this issue? Do you think that intellectual property should be shared freely or regulated? And if so, how? If you are an academic and you put out research papers, how do you feel about your information being shared freely? Earlier, Jessica mentioned entrenched interests, and we'll talk about who actually profits from these research papers. We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hello, yes. I find it disgusting that the Department of Justice would have assumed that position. I firmly believe that if a person obtained a degree as a result of getting any financial aid or educational loans, which we as the public are the ones that provide the money for through our tax dollars, I believe that then their scholarly journals and any intellectual information that is derived from that degree should be made public. And should be allowed to be given freely and dispersed freely, as long as the person that's collecting it and dispersing it is not making any profit from the disbursement of that information. There should be no penalties associated with that. I find that to be disgusting that the Department of Justice would do such a thing. And I really hope this Aaron's law is, I'm very happy to hear that there is going to be a law that's going to maybe hopefully open up that. I'd like to hear more about Aaron's law, and I hope maybe we can have something on the website regarding that.
Yes, we do have something on the website at yourcallradio.org. Parker or Jessica, do you want to add anything more about Aaron's law?
Sure. So we at EFF have been consulting on the way that that should be reformed, and we've been speaking with Rep. Lofgren's office. And Aaron's Law is a good start. It codifies part of it. It codifies a conclusion that's already been reached in certain like district courts, which is that terms of service violations shouldn't be felonies, and that makes sense intuitively, that if you and I come to an agreement or, you know, the terms of service on a website that people don't even read, violation of that may be a problem, but it shouldn't be a crime. And that's good. And it also, the most recent version goes a little further. And you mentioned earlier in the show that it decriminalizes changing like individual user ID kind of things. And that's good. It should go a little further. We've outlined the major areas where it should change, and this is, I mean, we could do another show on CFAA reform. It's a very the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, is dense, and it's showing its age, and it really it's good to see some change, but it might take more than one try to get this right.
Anything to add, Jessica?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I mean, EFF has been a wonderful champion of these, of supporting good laws and denouncing bad ones. So I feel I don't have much to add on that side, but I would say that, clearly these laws were based on a time when not as many people used the internet, when under public understanding of what, you know, terms of service was and all those, you know, sort of things that were very technical at one point but are very commonplace now. And the whole idea of a hacker has changed so much in the public eye mm-hmm. that these laws are just incredibly outdated, and it's really great that they're making the effort to update them.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Lisa. We have an email from another Lisa who says, thank you for today's show, which is such an important topic both in and outside of the academic community. I want to let listeners know about eScholarship.org, which is the University of California's open access publishing system. Researchers affiliated with UC can publish their work here for free, and then that work is available to the world for free. We have over 50,000 publications and almost 50 journals spanning the range of disciplines. Thank you for that email, Lisa, and we'll put eScholarship.org on our website right after the show. And we also have a web comment from David who says, I want everyone in San Francisco to know that JSTOR is available through our public library system, and very easily so. Again, Aaron Swartz allegedly downloaded millions of documents from the subscription-based academic journal JSTOR. And so do you know if this is readily available in public libraries across the country?
It's there are different programs through which it's available. And that's really the kind of an outrageous thing here, is that he was able to download these files because he was on the campus at MIT, and because they're available to MIT students. And that's what I was saying before about it being a, sort of a dark problem. So he was allowed to download each of these, or maybe several of these, but he downloaded too many. And that's an arbitrary number. And it's, you know, if you knew Aaron, if you knew what he campaigned for, it was that you shouldn't have to be at MIT to access this information. It shouldn't be something that comes as a perk from being affiliated with an institution that can afford the JSTOR subscription, or the library who can afford the tens of thousands of dollars a year per journal in some cases. And so it really is just leveling the playing field, and that should be the crime is kind of it feels
well, 35 years. I mean, the guy was 26 years old. It doesn't matter how old you are, but 35 years.
Well,
and we have another comment about this, about libraries. Our academic journals, they're widely available in most libraries, right?
In many university libraries. Maybe Jessica can speak more to this.
Yeah, maybe I'll add in a bit about that. I'd say that the problem is that if you are an average person interested in this particular topic, you'd like to educate yourself about something, maybe a health condition that you have, maybe a topic of scholarly interest that you have a passion for, maybe you want to start studying in a new field, anything that sort of increases the flow of information to the individual, it's really hard and frustrating to find access. You might find it at your local library, but they might not subscribe to the specific journal that you want. You might find it at your university library, but you might have to be there during their open hours in a specific building, standing, you know, sitting there you know, and then you have to come back the next day and sit down at the same desk and access it. It's just sort of this very archaic system that doesn't take into account the fact that this is information that people, that the public, that can improve the level of understanding the public of scientific topics and humanities topics and social scientific topics, and that information can be accessed anywhere. It's sort of this old system that means that in different places at different times you have very different rules. So if you want to find an article about something, it's just very frustrating. You go to one library, it works, but then they're not open, and then you go somewhere else, and then, you know, maybe you're in a town where you're 40 miles away from the nearest university library. Like, it's just a sort of, it increases the burden on the people who can be spared, which are the people who just want to learn something about the world based on most likely publicly sponsored research that they pay for.
Well, and we have a related question, and this goes back to what you talked about earlier, Jessica, about entrenched interests. And we have an email from Catherine who says, this is a really important show. I'm an academic, and I've seen up close how the privatization of information affects students and the wider society. Almost all peer-reviewed research is done with the financial support of public money, either through grants from public agencies like the NSF or from supposedly nonprofit research foundations. Most of it is done by people who work for public institutions, universities, and colleges. The product of this public investment should be openly available to all. The public has already paid for the research and should not be charged again to access what they paid for in the first place. She goes on to say, as an academic, I feel fine about sharing my peer-reviewed papers with anyone who wants to read them. I often send copies of the same to people who request them. Privatizing the system is a way of controlling public inquiry and assembly. What are your thoughts on that, Jessica?
Oh, I agree completely. I was giving a talk about open citizen science crowdfunding campaign that I'm running to sequence the human microbiome, which is the bacteria that live on all of us. And we're bringing the science for that directly to the public. And I was giving a talk about this, and there was someone had a very specific question about how the microbiome, the bacteria that live on us, were affected by a particular, event in a person's life. And I said, oh, well, you should go on Google Scholar and use these search terms and see what you find. And I thought, oh, well, you know, whatever she finds, she probably won't be able to read. It'll cost her, you know, $50 an article to even see if it's the right article for what she wants. So I said, well, of course, you know, just email me and I'll find you the article. But how awful is that? That is the way that she can find out information about research like she said, was paid for by the public, that she actually paid for. And that's very relevant to her concerns about her health.
Mm. What are your thoughts about Catherine's email? And is there... are we on a track to privatize a lot of information?
Absolutely. I think that that's a major problem. And I think that, again, one of the costs that you don't necessarily see is that the members of the public who don't have access to this could benefit, and we don't know. And I think that Aaron's life was a great example, that if the process of he was listed as a co-author on the RSS spec when he was 14, which was developed with a working group that puts together a lot of the technologies on the web. If that had been closed and privatized, there's no way that a 14-year-old would have been included and right. could have caught up to speed there. But it's an open process, and it was publicly available, and so he was able to get involved. And the spec is better for that. And so, you know, we wouldn't want to lose that with other research.
On today's Your Call, we are talking about open access to knowledge. This debate has been reignited because of the suicide of Aaron Swartz. And where do you stand on this very important issue? It's Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW. If you have a perspective you haven't heard yet in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by phoning 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question online at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about how cities should deal with the growing elderly homeless population. I just completed a 3-month research project looking into older homeless women in San Francisco, and this problem is exploding, and not many people are talking about it. So tomorrow we will. We will talk about why this is happening, why it's growing, and what are we as a society going to do to help this vulnerable and growing segment of our population. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about open access to knowledge. This very important debate has been reignited by the tragic suicide of Aaron Swartz on January 11th. He took his own life. He was just 26. This happened just weeks before the start of his trial. It's hard to believe, but he was facing up to 35 years in prison for allegedly downloading almost 5 million documents from the subscription-based academic journal JSTOR at an MIT computer lab. And we just checked the library website for San Francisco. And if you have a library card, you can access JSTOR. So as our guest said, there's really some information's free on at this library at MIT. It could be free, but for you, if you're using a computer, you might have to pay for it. So where do you stand on this important issue? Do you think information should be free? How are copyright laws affecting our access to information? Do you think intellectual property should be regulated? If so, how? If you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Parker Higgins, an activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in issues at the intersection of freedom of speech and copyright, trademark, and patent law. Jessica Richman was an acquaintance of Aaron Swartz. After his death, she and Eva Vivalt started a Twitter campaign to honor Aaron and the open internet he fought for. You can check it out, #PDFTribute. Since then, tens of thousands of files have been shared via Twitter. And we have a caller who wants to comment on just the 35 years in prison and how is this a crime. Let's hear from Kevin in San Francisco. Hi, Kevin. Thanks for holding.
Two quick comments, and thank you for explaining Aaron's case in detail in a way that wasn't reported in the wider media, that just made it sound like a theft. I mean, I could, you know, thinking of the pre-internet analogy, if Aaron had instead gathered together all the free Bay Guardians he could find and gave them away, would that be a crime because they didn't come from a newspaper machine? And he didn't deny anyone access to those digital articles that were there, so he didn't curtail anyone's access. And we should consider this, I would think, all researchers, this is published information, and consider this case in light of Jonas Salk giving away the polio vaccine and not patenting it because it was good for mankind.
Salk said, Salk was asked about whether he wanted to patent the vaccine, and he laughed and he said, "Can you patent the sun?" I think that the results of our there'd be a good case for this, as the results of our scientific endeavor should be free, even if there wasn't the public funding. But the fact that we've already, as taxpayers, funded a lot of the research and then paid the salaries in many cases of the people who did the peer review. I would be for open science anyway, but asking the public to pay for something not once, not twice, but three times, common sense revolts.
What are your thoughts? I just want to ask you about this petition to fire Boston Assistant U.S. Attorney Stephen Hyman for his prosecution of Aaron Swartz. They needed 25,000 signatures by today, which they got. They got 25,200. Many reports say there's little chance that Hyman will lose his job, but this petition could keep the debate over the prosecution tactics alive. What are your thoughts on this, Parker?
Well, I think it's important to realize that this I worry that such a petition makes it sound like this particular prosecutor was a bad apple and that the system is basically good. This is how the hacking laws are applied. And this was an egregious example, but there are many egregious examples. And I understand that there's a lot of bad feelings associated with that particular prosecutor and Carmen Ortiz as well.
Right. And Carmen Ortiz was the U.S. attorney, or is the U.S. attorney, I should say.
Yes.
Right.
But I think that we also should be focusing on more fundamental reforms than that.
And do we know, Jessica, has the DOJ gone after anyone else for the same reasons?
Well, there was an earlier case by the same prosecutor, and I think Parker could probably speak more to this, but there was an earlier case by the same prosecutor who had someone else had been driven to death under very similar circumstances, being charged with sort of facing really outrageous punishments for something that they, that was only sort of in a gray area of being a crime at all. I guess Parker can speak to other cases where that are more current about abuses of this law.
Yeah, I think there's a logical nexus between copyright in that way and then these computer crime laws, that the fact that there's a computer in the middle opens it up to much more prosecutorial discretion and much harsher penalties in a way that doesn't really make sense with the way society works today. So one analogy that I've heard that is it's pretty evocative is that if you're found hacking a web server, then you can face 5 years in prison. If you actually take a wrench to the web server and destroy it, that's 1 year, because that's just property. And so that just doesn't make sense. And it's the same with if you were to write out a page of a book by hand, that's maybe it's theoretically copyright infringement, but it's not something that anyone would go after in the past.
Well, yeah, and we have a related question from Raul in Nevada who couldn't stand the line. He said, why was Swartz facing such steep punishment versus bankers who crashed the economy and not one of them, not forget jail, they haven't even been prosecuted.
Yeah,
And this came up the last time we did a show about this.
Yeah.
That's a huge miscarriage of justice, right? The difference in penalties between the difference between the amount of social harm actually done and the penalties that people face is just astounding. The difference between these two things. And I think Parker really had it when he said it's a difference between the way the law is written. It's written to make make computer crimes way more punished with way more drastic punishments than other types of crimes, especially financial crime.
Another thing, and you see this across the spectrum in debates over copyright, is that it was, Aaron downloaded or is alleged to have downloaded millions of documents, and there's a number associated with that. It's, $26 million worth of documents or something. But this number is basically imaginary. And a lot of reports say that JSTOR urged dropping the charges after he returned the files. And this, it's a metaphor that just doesn't make sense. You can't return something because he just had copied in the first place. They were never missing anything. So he, stole $26 million or whatever the number was, and he returned this thing when really you lose sight of the fact that he made a copy of and then deleted that copy. And I think that when you stick to the old metaphors, you end up with these really out of whack prosecutions.
Yeah, I want to comment also on the idea that they're worth $26 million, whatever the figure was. I mean, these are academic articles that are very valuable to the public in the sense of a source of information and sort of basis for scientific discussion in our society, but it's like you can go resell them on the open market, and it's going to give you $26 million for a bunch of academic articles that they could access themselves, most likely, if they went to all the trouble of driving to the library and sitting in the library. There's no market for these things.
And we have a comment from Jackie who says, charging for research paid by our taxes is the crime here. Thank you for the email, Jackie. Now I would like to welcome John Walensky to the show. Professor Walensky teaches at Stanford University. He's a professor of education there. He also directs the Public Knowledge Project, which is dedicated to conducting research and developing software that extends the public and scholarly quality of academic publishing. He's the author of several books, including Technologies of Knowing and the Access Principle. Hi, Professor Walensky, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Rose. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. So we're getting so much response from listeners, many, many emails saying, I cannot believe the government went cracked down so hard on Aaron Swartz. Does that still surprise you?
Yes, it does. And I've been listening to the call. I just wanted to add a few elements that have been discussed. One of them of concern to me, at least, is the level of open access that is available. And we do have a figure on that. It's about 20 to 22% of the research that's published each year. People are making available for others to use, and it's a growing movement. And so part of the recognition of Aaron's contribution has to revolve around the sense in which there is something underway and people are making an effort.
And so where do you see this going from here? Because this has reignited this discussion about open access to knowledge.
Yeah, I'm very hopeful in terms of a number of different developments. I mean, I think the federal government is taking a hit on this, and it should for the way it's handled the case. But we also have to recognize that the National Institutes of Health have a policy that requires everyone who takes federal money within the NIH program to deposit a copy of the work that they publish within a year of publication. So there is legislation on the books that recognizes the public's right to this information, and at least in the area of health, and I think it should be extended to all federal programs, there is legislation that supports the public's right to this knowledge.
Well, we have a number of callers on this. People are clearly interested in this topic. So let's go through a few and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Cannoli in El Sobrante. Hi, Cannoli. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to just make two comments. One was, as an alumni at UC Berkeley, I have paid for a library card to access the library. And when I got there, I found out I can look at all the books, but only professors and students were allowed to access the journals. That's just a comment. The other thing I wanted to point out is a little bit different, is that there are all kinds of public records that are legally required to be made available to the public, which you can see if you go down to a county courthouse. But governments all across the country sell these to private firms, and if you want to get them over the Internet, you have to pay a huge amount of money for actually for public documents, and that's always annoyed me. I mean, stuff like recorded deeds or all kinds of stuff which you can just get, you know, if you go to the county. But you kind of pay a lot of money if you want to get them over the Internet.
Yeah, it harkens back to something that Aaron had been involved with previously, which is the public court records that, you know, in this country, you know, it's very important that we have access to this because it's what makes up our law in many cases. And it's in a system called PACER, which is only available if you pay per page and you have to register. And Aaron had previously, through a library program, downloaded about 20% of the U.S. court documents through PACER, and to make freely available. These are things without copyright. This is actually public domain material that was just locked up. And that was several years before he was investigated by the FBI, but there was no charge because it's again, public domain materials. And that gives you a sense of you know, he was working on that same kind of problem.
And do you see that changing anytime soon?
I would love to see that change. Again, it affects some people a lot, but those people are often, you know, if you work at a law firm, you're not bearing the cost necessarily. And so the general public who would benefit from this doesn't know that this is not available to them.
Just jump in for a second on the cost element. I mean, I think it has to be recognized that there is a cost to publishing these materials, even though they've been federally financed in terms of the research. And I think the crux of it is that the money that goes into publishing needs to be seen as a public investment, and that the journals still have to be paid for, but they don't have to be locked up. And I think it takes a major shift in thinking. But it is to say that we still need to invest in these journals. We just need to make sure that they're publicly available at the same time.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling, Cannoli. Let's hear next from Steve in Mountain View. Hi, Steve.
Hi. The previous gentleman just pointed out one of my issues that I wanted to present, which is that I publish in journals, and someone has to pay the journals to edit my work, create the peer group review, do all those things, and my work was not paid for by government work. Some of my articles were paid for by private industry. I've worked for NASA. I've worked for universities, and it varies who is going to pay for what. The public does not always pay to create journal articles, nor edit them, nor put them online. Someone has to pay for that. It is naive to believe that all information should be made free. Someone has to bear the burden, whether it be universities or government. On the other issue of this unfortunate gentleman who committed suicide over the prosecution by the government, I think we ought to go into the Department of Justice and examine whether their prosecutorial process is really fair, and whether even those people in the government who zealously or overzealously pursue these people ought to be reined in. We have legislators. We ought to contact them and have them examine this. Your people on the air did a marvelous job explaining the cockamamie balance of prosecution for web-based crime versus the billions and trillions of dollars lost by bankers in their pursuit of gold, and no one has been prosecuted.
Right. And Steve, I'm curious, can you elaborate a bit more on your argument about why some of these journals should have a fee?
Well, many of the journals are private journals, whether it be Geophysics, Physics Today. Many of the journals have staffs of people. These are not supported by the government. They're not supported by industry. They're supported by payments. You buy a journal article, you pay a fee, and that supports the staff. These are not public organizations. Most journals are not supported by the federal government or any government. They're private enterprises.
Well, Steve, let's get a response from Jessica, and stay on the line if you'd like to respond to her, because Jessica is co-founder of Science Citizen. This is a nonprofit that encourages academic scientists to include citizen science in their research. So, Jessica, what are your thoughts on Steve's argument?
Well, I mean, I think it overlooks a few. I mean, I think it's a valid argument that these journals are private businesses, but I think it overlooks sort of the fundamental basis of what their raw materials are that go into their business, and then who the consumers are of the content that comes out of their business. Most of the research that goes into the journal articles, the raw materials for the journal articles, was supported by public funds. Even if it's university funds, it's often a public grant or it's a public university. So what they're building on is actually already publicly supported. And then the work of the reviewers that sort of process the raw materials that go into their business is often professors who are supported by public grants or who work at public universities. So although they are a private business, much of what they're depending on is products produced by public funds. Another issue is that, as John pointed out, and I thought this was really good, is that there are, you know, NIH grant, research funded by NIH grants has to be made public. That's a condition of receiving the grant on PubMed. That's what PubMed is the open access platform for research funded by the NIH. And in the field of physics, there's archive. There are other disciplines that do and conditions under which people have open access to data, and that model works in those fields. So I don't think it's a huge stretch to say it would work across many other fields as well and allow everyone to have access to it while still supporting a publishing platform. These are these are publishing platforms that have been shown to work. And they work according to a very different model than the private publishers building on public research model.
Professor Walensky?
So we're looking at the spending of libraries around the world at about $6 billion on subscriptions and fees to journals. And again, those libraries are very interested in acquiring that information, but they don't have to have an exclusive hold on it. It would be of great value to the libraries, in fact, if they could share this information with the public and establish that they were providing this kind of service. So the idea is that the journals do need the money. $6 billion may be used, maybe some waste in that, but generally that's the cost. and the libraries would be happy to continue to pay that fee if we could turn the journals to open access, if we could make sure that the journals were then well covered in terms of their costs, but could make their information public.
Another thing I'd just like to add to that, when we were doing PDF Tribute and when the movement was just starting to catch on, librarians from libraries all across the U.S. and in the U.K. and Canada, we're saying we have an open access archive for our university, for example. So university librarians were saying, here at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for example, we have an archive where all the research of our professors is open access to anyone. It was just hard to find. So I think the libraries are sort of a hidden ally in this, or maybe not so hidden ally in this, in that librarians often can find you the one copy of the 19 versions of the article that the public can access. And that sort of undermines the whole idea that, it's destroying some existing business that needs to exist. The data is often out there. It's just hard for people to find. And that difficulty and that frustration makes it hard for people to engage meaningfully with science. And that's something that's kind of funny. Our government also spends, hundreds of millions of dollars trying to increase public engagement in science, at the same time making it hard for people to access scientific journals. So I think the system just needs to be rethought.
Steve, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
What are your thoughts?
We still haven't gotten around to how the journals are going to be funded, whether they are indirectly funded through libraries that pay fees and then freely distribute the information. Basically, it comes down to you need staffs of people to edit these articles, to collate it, to put them together, to put it online. Someone has to pay for that. And whether the public does it through their libraries or universities paying, it's still being done. Now, I'm not against having the information freely dispersed, through libraries. That's up to the journals, certainly, to make that decision. But you still have to have a staff of people. Information doesn't come free. Whether you're paid for by universities, whether you're paid for by the government or private industry, someone has to sit there and labor over an article.
All right. Well, let's
collate all that information together.
Let's get a response to that, Professor Walensky. What about that?
No, I think we're actually in agreement, and that is that we think the information has to be paid for. The question is whether it has to be locked up. And let me add one little element on JSTOR that needs some clarification. I think JSTOR actually stands for Journal Storage. That all of the articles in JSTOR had already been published, and that this was an archive created after the journals had been published, after the subscriptions had been paid, in fact, the journals in JSTOR are all older than 2 or 3 years, some of them running back to the 17th century. So the idea is that in fact, the money is available. It's on the table. It has been paid in the case of JSTOR and will be paid. And it's just a matter of public expectations, of scholars making a lot of noise about it, that we now are in an age when this information can circulate on existing budgets and be a public resource.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Steve. We've got just a few minutes left. We have an email from Faye who says, President Obama controls his Justice Department. It was our president's policies issued to justice that caused the prosecution. Have any journalists questioned Obama about this case in briefings? Parker, do you know?
I haven't seen that, if it's happened. And I think that I do agree that we shouldn't, that you know, follow it up as high as it will reasonably go. But again, this wasn't that much of an outlier in terms of the way that these laws are applied, and I think that's the real problem. It's not in particular that Aaron was targeted. It's that that these laws are applied with a lot of arbitrary discretion, and that happens regularly, and so. I think that, again, the problem is more fundamental than going after one person or you know, really solving this one case can address.
And Molly, our intern, who's a Dynamite researcher, found an article by Will Bunch, a reporter in Philadelphia, who wrote in the Huffington Post, quote, Aaron Swartz had the misfortune of taking his civil action in a nation that seems to treat crimes committed with a computer more harshly than crimes committed with a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's kind of a shocking comparison, isn't it?
It is. But, I mean, you look at what we're facing right now. We're almost out of time. Jessica, you and your friend Eva Vivalt started the Twitter campaign, hashtag PDF Tribute, to honor Aaron and the open internet he fought for. Where is this going from here, based on what you're seeing with this campaign?
It's a really good question. I think it raised a lot of awareness. It was a big, you know, it made a lot of noise for a couple of days, which was great, and got, you know, these sorts of things going. But I think it also served to bring together disparate groups that were working on different aspects of open access. I've been contacted by people from many different organizations that are all working in, some of them in specific fields, like there's an organization, Humanities, that had contacted me, and then some of them are working from different angles. And I think it serves to bring that group together, and that's something we want to do going forward, is to bring together these groups of people that were all working on the same problem but can now be catalyzed by this greater public awareness.
And Professor Walensky, 30 seconds.
Again, I would just reinforce the idea that there is something underway in terms of increasing access, and that the public needs to continue to be interested and express its interest in seeing this go forward.
And Parker?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've revisited a lot of copyright laws in the past several years, and it's something that we need to get right in order to really maximize the public's access and the creation of new materials.
Parker Higgins is an activist with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jessica Richman was an acquaintance of Aaron Swartz. She and her friend Eva Vivalt started the Twitter campaign to honor Aaron at hashtag PDF Tribute. She's also co-founder of Science Citizen, and John Walensky is professor of education at Stanford. He also directs the Public Knowledge Project. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you for your many phone calls and emails. Be sure to check yourcallradio.org for links to more on this, and also where you can find free and open information. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How should cities deal with the growing elderly homeless population? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about older homeless people. Their numbers are expected to double by 2050, but they're rarely mentioned when we discuss the homeless population. So who are they? And what factors are contributing to the rise in homelessness among older people? What programs are in place to help this vulnerable and growing segment of our society? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Eric Jansen is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.